Ms. Friedman.
Good morning. May it please the Court. The issue presented in this appeal is whether, in the wake of Dukes v. Walmart, Rule 23C allows class liability cases to proceed under a disparate impact or disparate treatment theory under the Teamsters case, even if foul
on... You
don't
mean just disparate treatment, do you? I thought that you had gotten, at least your briefs in this Court, made me think that you were pushing... disparate impact or perhaps pattern of practice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. A pattern of practice under the Teamsters approach claim is what we requested, a certification under Rule 23C4 of the disparate impact liability portion of the Teamsters portion of the disparate treatment claim.
Okay, so I'm just going to give you what I think is the critical question for you to answer. The Supreme Court in Walmart was very concerned with the vagueness and inherent case specificity of a claim based only on too much discretion in managers. Some managers may be saints, others may be devils, others may be somewhere in between. And you, in your briefs, I think have acknowledged that that was a problem, you know, something that you can't do. You can't just talk about discretion. So if this is going to be any kind of case that could possibly be cognizable, even as an issues class, what specific policies do you want forbidden to Merrill Lynch? What focus do you have?
Thank you. The answer to your question lies in Title VII. There are two components to the segregation clause, that it's unlawful for an employer.
Speak louder. I can't hear you.
Yes, I'm sorry. It is unlawful for an employer to segregate the workforce, but the segregation alone does not create a violation. If the employer says all whites must sit on one side of the room, all African Americans sit on the other side of the room.
I don't think that's the question.
I want you to tell me, you know, suppose just for the sake of argument, you just have to bear with me, that managers of financial analysts at Merrill Lynch are currently permitted to take five things into account when they decide who gets assigned to teams or when they decide who's going to be given a portfolio within the office or whatever. And they have discretion. I mean, there certainly is discretion here. As I understood your theory, and I could be wrong, you think that one or more of those things that they are presently using in their management structure have an impermissible disparate impact that is not justified by any business justification, as Griggs says. And I want you to tell me as plainly as you can what needs to be removed from the package in order to cleanse the system, if you will, of the disparate impact.
There are two policies, account distribution and teaming. The account distribution has one part of it that is purely objective. It's a ranking system. Financial advisors earn points, and they're scored on these points, and then the first person with the most points walks in the door and selects the account that they want, then the next person walks in. That is a purely objective system.
What's it based on? The income to Merrill Lynch from their customers or what?
There are a number of different factors that are used to score the points. One of the factors is revenue to Merrill Lynch. One of the factors is whether they have been invited to be part of a recognition club, which is also based on revenue. Another one of the
recognition club. What's that?
They if somebody hits a certain level of production, $500,000 in production, will be invited on a trip.
To Merrill Lynch.
A double hit. They're getting it the points under revenue, and then they're getting the points under recognition club. What the plaintiffs allege is that the points are skewed because of the discrimination.
Firm. That's I have the same problem that Judge Wood does. So in the ordinary disparate impact case, you have, say, a requirement that you have a college degree in order to dig ditches or something. And this has a disparate impact, and it's not justified by business needs, so it's illegal, right? So what's the counterpart in this case? Something that that affects these people's incomes, black people's, the black brokers' incomes, and isn't justifiable by the needs of the business.
And that takes you back to the training program and this issue with teams. What happens is that the financial advisors are allowed to team with whomever they select to team with. And then that's part of the practice. But the other part of
it is that
the injunction
no
to
teams
say that Merrill Lynch
can't have
henceforth
teams.
Cannot allow the advisors to pick their own teams because even though they're because there's an insufficiently powerful business justification. You see, my problem is both of the things that you're talking about, ranking by these various criteria, most of which seem somehow or another to be related to revenues brought in, or teaming, on the surface of things, look like pretty normal business behavior to me. And you might say in the college diploma example, well, it's normal for a business to want a college diploma too, but there is this burden-shifting business that the Supreme Court created in Griggs that we've continued to observe for disparate impact cases. So facially neutral policies might turn out just not to link up well enough to what the business is trying to do, hire a ditch digger or whatever. But, and I know this, I mean, we're in this world now where the merits and the class certification issues do blur substantially one into the other. But unless I can conceptualize some specific policy of Merrill Lynch that in at the end of the day you might get an injunction against, as I said, take this element out of the bundle of sticks that the managers can use, then I don't see how you get over Walmart's concern about diffuseness and the necessity of really going down to the individual level.
If I may, if you take a parallel example, might be if a police department, for example, allowed its officers to select with whom they wanted to partner. And due to gender stereotypes, men chose not to partner with women because they were afraid women wouldn't protect them or they were afraid that their wives might get angry. Those are some of the older line cases. That segregation of the workforce, which is the women would be left without partners, would be actionable if it caused a deprivation of an opportunity. So in order to be promoted.
So the injunction would say, don't let the people choose their own partners. That's got to be done at the management level to ensure objectivity of choice and no discriminator's veto or whatever you want to call that.
It's easier at the training level. At the training level, there's two parts to it. One is a young white man walks in.
I don't understand. Why did you move off of that?
Yeah.
So you have your police case. Now, is the team, is Merrill Lynch's team system the same thing?
Identical. It's very similar to if the police department then said, in order to receive a promotion or to be on...
Forget the police department.
It's very...
The team. Okay. So now how is the team... These brokers have carte blanche to select anybody to be on their team?
That's true. The brokers themselves, that's the statement in the briefs, the brokers themselves select with whom to team.
What do they get out of picking team members?
That's the part of it. They get benefits. So, for example, if an older white person wanted to help a younger white person through the training program, that person can team and steer assets.
The young person. What? I mean, forget the white. If you're a team leader and you're picking team members, what is the financial implication for you of choosing one person over another to be on your team?
The teams are used in a number of different ways. One is succession planning. So if a person is leaving and they want to steer their assets to somebody who's staying, they can steer their assets
Why
to a financial advisor.
Their assets to someone who's staying?
They want to control who the clients go to and pass the book of business on to a friend or to someone who they believe would be...
So you take care of your customers, right?
Right, in a succession planning way that African Americans are excluded from.
Leaving Merrill Lynch?
Retiring.
And there actually was a study that when people left to go to the competition, and that's part of the record,
retires,
they steered the assets.
No, he will still derive some financial benefit from the activities of his team. Is that how it works?
Under some circumstances, they can. They can receive a trailing commission off of it. But the idea is that these friendships are built within these offices, that these men...
But my concern is, if the only motivation or the principal motivation for choosing a team member is some financial benefit to yourself, that would be fine, wouldn't it? I mean, that wouldn't be problematic.
The problem is that the record as a whole, what the record as a whole reflects, is that the firm has passed on these stereotypes about African Americans, and it's part of the defense of this case, that African Americans lack access to white wealth. It's a defense that did not succeed.
Right, isn't it?
They were not able to prove that defense. These African Americans went to the top schools in the country. They come to Merrill Lynch with credentials. They come with networks. They're screened, and they're in the same way whites are, to determine whether they would have the capacity or ability to build a book of business. And when the defense was put to the test,
if these team leaders are not picking black brokers who come from rich backgrounds, go to fancy schools and know a lot of rich people, which is probably the main criterion for being a broker, then they're hurting themselves, right?
But that could be said too in a lot of former discrimination cases too. I mean, if you excluded the woman from being the police officer, maybe she was going to be a terrific officer. But I think that, as I understand the theory, it's that this perpetuation of assumptions about who was going to be good. There's a difference between an assumption about who's going to be good and who actually would be good.
Correct. And the record testimony from the experts was that when African Americans managed the accounts, they garnered the same revenue as whites. And so we're talking about a situation where Merrill Lynch controls the distribution of these accounts. And they're allowing...
So what do you want... Do you want the teams enjoined? Is that the idea?
I think if you were to be sensitive about how you bring about change in that kind of an environment,
Do you want to abolish the teams or what?
In the training program, the benefits that connect to the teams should be abolished.
Training program. You've got these people who pick team members. Now, do you want that to be forbidden and say that the teams have to be selected, I don't know, by the CEO or what?
The benefit that goes with the team.
Answer my question.
Yeah,
what do you want
honestly,
done
you
with
help
that
yourself
the team?
If you are as specific as if you want teams abolished, you could say no more teams. If you simply want the manager of the office to review proposed team selections, you could say that. If you want the manager of the office to make team selections, you could say that. I don't know what you want either.
What the plaintiffs in this case want is that assets that transfer through teams that are disproportionately favoring whites not be included in making determinations on whether or not...
So the focus is on account transfers?
Account transfers that go through the teams.
Okay.
So what happens is you enter the training program, you must meet $10 million in assets under management. These teams are formed, the assets transfer through the teams, and then the top two quintiles of the training program are allowed to go on for national training, get sales assistance, get offices, and we know African Americans are 70% in the bottom quintiles.
At that point, if you get into the good team to begin with, you're on the path to great success, and if you're left behind at the outset, you never catch up. I think
why not let merit dictate that?
I don't follow you. What do you want to do to prevent that?
If you have a goal that you must meet $10 million, to graduate from
objective criteria.
Objective criteria.
Don't let the teams self-select. I mean, you need to under Walmart, you really need to be clear about a particular thing Merrill Lynch is now doing that they have to stop doing.
The objective rules that apply to teams need to be eliminated. If a financial advisor transfers assets to another financial advisor through a team, those assets should not be allowed to be used to compete against African Americans who don't have the benefit of those transfers.
I don't. You'll have to.
You have a 10-minute, $10 million goal. Everybody walks in. They're all green.
Let's start from the beginning. I'm lost completely now. Okay, now, the team is formed how?
Okay. What? Everybody walks into the Merrill Lynch as a brand new person. They're not licensed. They have no experience, and they need to have training. They enter into a training program that has goals. You must meet $10 million in production that you must bring into the firm.
Okay.
Our expert showed was that in 26 of the 28 months in the training program, statistically significant, disparate transfers.
Just explain how it works. I'm not interested in the consequences.
The way it works
You come in and you have to produce $10 million in clients or whatever. Okay, now what's the next step?
The next step is that if you're a standalone broker, you must do it on your own. You cold call, you hold seminars, you bring the clients in. If you're part of a team, the minute
you haven't even formed the team yet.
Look, someone asked.
You're not explaining yourself. You come in, you have a training session at which you try to, you know, raise $10 million. Okay. And if you don't raise the $10 million, you're out, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, suppose you've raised your $10 million. Now, what's the next step?
Well, the next step...
Well, isn't there an intermediate step? Some people are on their own. It's like a fork. Some people stay on their own and raise the $10 million on their own. Some people get a tap on the shoulder and say, we'd like you to be part of our team. So they go on the other branch of this fork, and they then, as I'm understanding you, get the benefit of the whole team's amounts of money, not just the money they did themselves.
Precisely. So the critical example would be you team with someone who has $100 million in assets, and they give you 10%.
Okay, so that's all right. That's clear. I understand. Now, so what you would like to do is what? To prevent the formation of the team at that stage or the sharing of business with a new team member, tapping the trainee to be on your team. You have $100 million. You like him, and you give him $10 million. Is that what you want to forbid?
Yes, a non-discriminatory.
Well, okay, so you forbid
that. I thought you also were saying a more modest allegation that, you know, of course, the person who's on his own is going to be evaluated on his own anyway. But I thought you just wanted to evaluate the person on the team without regard to these intra-team transfers, so that you leveled the evaluation process going forward. The person on the team also has to be looked at in terms of how much business he or she brought in.
Right.
Okay.
If I could take a moment, I know we've taken a lot of your time here, Ms. Freeman, but I'd like to focus in on the class issues in particular here, which is, I think, why we're here, not on the merits. If you are allowed to go forward with a disparate impact class focusing on the teaming policy and the account transfer policy, I need to know what you think the class issues would resolve, and I'll spell out my thinking a little bit, and then I'd like to have you respond. It seems to me you're hoping to be able to prove that those policies would in fact have disparate impacts and would not be justified by business reasons. I'm not frankly sure how you're going to prove causation, but I haven't, that's not really in front of us right now. But then you've told Judge Gettleman we want to have individual at least damages trials, and I think there would have to be some individual causation issues dealt with as well. Is that right?
That's right.
And that's where, for example, that would be in those individual trials or hearings, that would be the place for defense evidence, for example, that this plaintiff was actually on a team that helped him succeed, or this plaintiff said she didn't want to be on any team, she wanted to do it on her own, or this plaintiff said he didn't want assigned accounts on these transfers because they're no good anyway, he'd rather do it on his own. That's where that kind of individual issue would be dealt with.
That's right.
Okay.
And in the Manual for Complex Litigation, this has at least historically been a common part of class. That's why your reply brief focuses on C4.
Yes.
So I take it you are really, at this point, asking only for a C4 issues class on the validity of these policies, and you understand that there is no class by the time you get to the monetary part of the case.
That's correct. We believe that
that's
consistent with
Walmart. But what you want is... What you want is to require that everybody, all the trainees, be evaluated on their own contributions rather than on what they've received from their team. Is that what you want?
That's the remedy on the team part
Pardon?
Of it. That's the remedy, yes, sir, on the team, Your Honor, on the team part of it, that would be the remedy. On the account distribution part of it, what our expert showed was in 26 of the 28 months, the African Americans were receiving lower account distributions in the training program. That needs to end.
You say they're not being treated as well as other team members. Isn't that what you're saying?
When you compare the group of trainees, African Americans.
Are these black brokers, are they on teams? Or is it like a fraternity? They're not picked, or they're on a team, but they're not treated well on the team.
The evidence is overwhelming that they're excluded from these teams, much like a fraternity.
They're not on the teams at all.
That's correct.
And that puts them at a disadvantage.
Correct. There's something called pools,
so
where
Would you want them to be entitled to be on teams, or just not have the teams?
We would like the teams to be run in a non-discriminatory manner.
I don't know what that means.
That means that they shouldn't be used to transfer assets so that people meet goals. They should be legitimate teams, and African Americans should be included. If you try to talk about what the...
So you're saying the transfer feature of the team is improper because that's what facilitates this discrimination.
That's what's rigging the competition.
The 26 out of 28 months evidence, I mean, I think all of us understand that a brokerage house probably wants to favor its best producers. But 26 out of 28 months with brand new trainees is a little hard to explain based on long-term track records.
That's the power of that evidence.
Is that the idea?
Absolutely. Okay. That's the power of the evidence. Okay. If the answer to the statistics, why do African Americans earn 33 to 40% lower wages than whites, which is undisputed, if the answer is success, you must ask the question, how does that occur in the first month of the training program and the next 26 of 28, where success has not yet been set? And what the plaintiffs allege is that it's rigged from the start. If you're transferring these assets disproportionately through the teams and through the account distributions, beginning in the first month, so that the attrition is statistically significant, and those who remain, 70% are in the bottom two production quintiles. And Merrill Lynch has never offered any defense that African Americans were not equally capable.
Okay.
Or in
Fine.
Any regard.
Okay, thanks. We'll have to move on. So thank you, Ms. Friedman. Mr. Bishop?
May it please the Court, perhaps you don't want to hear this and move me on if you don't, but we really think this case should be dismissed. And I realize that this is the same panel that denied the 23F a year ago and granted it this time.
I know there's language in cases you can rely on, although the cases are distinguishable, but this is an unusual situation where we don't have to take an appeal. You have to the appellant has to ask for us to do so. That means there's no danger of our being flooded with interlocutory appeals and slowing down the litigation in the district court, right?
Judge Posner,
if it's an appeal that would interrupt things and cause more delay than it's worth, then we just won't allow it.
The systemic problems are in the district court, not in this court.
Because the district court practically begged us to take this case. I mean, he couldn't have.
What you're encouraging, and I will move on, but what you're encouraging to do.
Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that this is not a 23F appeal, that 23F has certain time limits and they aren't satisfied here. There's not a word in 1292B about any particular time limit. It is the residual authority for interlocutory appeals that Congress has given to the courts of appeals. And if you like case authority, you know, the language in Asher against Baxter International makes it pretty clear that 1292B remains an option in the discretion, as Judge Posner says, of actually both courts.
Right.
The district court, if the district court doesn't think it's 1292B, it doesn't even get started. And if the 10 days is met and the Court of Appeals thinks it's not worth it, it doesn't go forward. So there are tremendous safeguards. And
I'm happy to rely on my brief for that argument.
Here we are.
Here we are. This is a case where Judge Gettleman, based on a massive record, after 3 years of discovery, held there is no common issue.
You know what? I have to interject with one point about this. The rules of civil procedure were changed to push back the time for class certification to at an early practicable time from what had formerly been at the earliest time. And simultaneously, a move was developed, in part inspired by this court, to say you really did need to think about the merits and you had to go through your Daubert stuff and all the rest of it for class certification. And that yields this monster, $12 million and counting, on class certification.
It does, and I've been involved in many cases with similar.
I know.
But the fact is, the class certification, as this court's opinions recognize, can often be the critical part of the case because, in many cases, settlement will occur if class is certified. So I think for the defense bar, we think that this is where the attention should be at the class certification stage. But we do have a massive record. Judge Gettleman looked at it 3 times.
Is there any discovery left that you're going to have to do if this case goes forward?
I don't know. I wasn't heavily involved in doing the discovery here. We certainly have a substantial record.
If you go forward with a couple of hundred cases in MDL litigation, there's going to be a lot more discovery. I'm pretty confident of that.
I think one of the things from our point of view is we think that if these go as they should to individual cases, a lot of these plaintiffs will drop out. We will not be talking about there are 700 people in this putative class. We don't think there will be 700 claims.
But once you get to individual... thing would happen if they get their issue class and an injunction is issued addressing the teaming policy and the account transfer policy. That's, of course, assuming they win. You'll be thrilled if they lose. You know, you'll be.
And they will. When we think they will lose.
And I don't prejudge that at all. But should they win on this and get the injunction, they're going to have to go to individual proceedings, I think, anyway, on any kind of relief, at which point anyone who doesn't step forward for his or her hearing is out of the case anyway.
I have not heard any issue in this case that can be certified, and Judge Gettleman certainly didn't find one.
I'm not sure that's true after Walmart, because there's a difference between pure discretion and attention to the boundaries of discretion.
Both of those were involved in Walmart.
No, not in Walmart.
Don't interrupt the judge.
I'm sorry.
The problem with Walmart was that their whole attack was on a policy. I'm looking at page beginning of subpart C of Justice Scalia's opinion. He says the only corporate policy that the plaintiff's evidence convincingly establishes is Walmart's, quote, he put scare quotes, policy of italics allowing discretion by local supervisors over employment matters. I think that these plaintiffs are trying very hard not to do that, wisely enough.
With all due respect, Judge Wood, that's not the case. It is true that the compensation claim in Walmart was discretion all the way down, but the promotion claim was not. The promotion claim, there were three elements to the promotion claim that were objective, three objective criteria to which the plaintiffs objected. Those criteria were that the person had been in employment for a year or more in their current job, that they have above average reviews, and that they'd be willing to relocate. The plaintiffs in Walmart objected that the relocation requirement in particular was discriminatory against women. In the dissent,
that's not what Justice Scalia, however, focuses on in the opinion. The opinion...
Well, he did... I'm sorry.
The opinion says this is really, at the end of the day, just about discretion.
Well, that's true, because under these criteria, there were discretion. Here we have two policies.
That's the point. Well, okay.
All right. This case is exactly like Walmart. We have two policies.
And your brief actually has so many quotes from Walmart that it's actually hard to break out when you're talking about Walmart and when you're talking about this case.
Well, of course, we think the cases are absolutely parallel.
I know, but these long quotes, a page, it goes on for seven lines or eight lines, and then all of a sudden we've just changed the subject.
We have two policies here, one of which, teaming, is discretion all the way down. There is one objective requirement in the teaming policy.
But the problem is the decision to grant discretion can itself be attacked, right?
Well, it could have been in Walmart, too. But for the class certification purpose, if discretion plus a disparate outcome were enough for class certification.
So Ms. Friedman made an argument which, on its face, sounds perfectly plausible, that if you allow these team leaders to, if this is like a fraternity, and they pick their pals and they transfer money to them or accounts to them, and as a result they do well, and if that's a judgment made by Merrill Lynch that has a disparate impact and can't be just, maybe it can be justified, of course, but suppose it can't be, then that could be that's the class-wide issue. If that were determined, then there would be these multiple damage causation hearings that Judge Hamilton mentioned. But why is that inconsistent with Walmart?
Because the teams are put together. Can I explain how the teams work? You asked how these work. The teams, of which fewer than 50% of Merrill Lynch FAs are on teams, the only objective element is that the managers must approve a team. The teams are a way for FAs, who basically run their own small business, to decide whether they want to work with others or not. Many choose to work alone. Some want to team. Some want to team with someone who has a different skill. Someone may be a very good money manager. Another person may be very good at prospecting clients. The plaintiffs in this case...
Well, who picks the team?
The team, FAs. An FA will decide, I want to be on a team. I don't want to be on a team. If I want a team, perhaps I want a team with this person.
Isn't there a team leader?
No, there's no team leader. I mean, what happens in practice is that successful...
You go to some of these other brokers and you say, I want to be on your team. And they say, oh, we don't like you. We don't want you on our team. And then he ends up on no team. And then
50% of our brokers are on no team, and many of them are very, very successful.
Well, yeah, but suppose there are some miserable people who want to be on a team. They don't.
Why
think
should
they
be
could,
on a team if no one wants to be on a team with them?
Interrupt us, please.
I'm sorry,
Judge. That's kind of basic. You don't interrupt
us. I'm sorry, Judge.
We interrupt you. You don't interrupt us, all right? So there could be... obviously, the fact that the team is that half of the people are on teams suggests that, depending on your personality and so on, it might be very important to you to be on a team, right? And if it just so happens that because of stereotypes, about black people. They have trouble getting onto teams, and it hurts them. Why couldn't that be challenged and enjoined, and then left the and then there'd be all these individual hearings on damages?
Well, I don't think that Walmart.
Why is that excluded by Walmart?
Because in Walmart, the managers were, according to the plaintiffs in Walmart, picking people for higher raises or for management because they were men rather than women. Right? The same could be said, the argument you just made, the same could have been said in Walmart. But Justice Scalia said there is no class. If this is going to be determined, it can't be determined
at
class.
A million people in the class in Walmart?
Walmart,
I mean, that's related to Judge Hamilton's point. You always have to balance the benefits of the class treatment with the consequences for...
You do.
Well,
what you have to find is an issue...
Walmart, is it, you know, whether this is enough is obviously for us to decide. But, again, in Walmart, as Justice Scalia sets up the case, he says the basic theory of there, that is to say the plaintiff's case, is that a strong and uniform corporate culture permits bias against women to infect the discretionary decision-making. Here, these plaintiffs are saying there's a particular policy, the way teams are created, that we're going to focus on. Maybe there are other things out there that the company's doing too, but there's one policy. If you just vaguely talk about a corporate culture that affects 1.5 million people, I mean, it didn't surprise too many people that the Supreme Court rejected this class.
Plaintiffs here, using the same expert, are talking about a corporate culture that vaguely affects 15,000 Merrill Lynch FAs 700. And the 700 class members here. And Judge Gettleman held quite properly that BLB had failed to take into account the way that these policies operate. He had failed to consider whether race...
There's a focus on the policies, though. I don't think you can put words in the plaintiff's mouth. They're attacking the teaming policy and the account transfer policy.
But their evidence...
It's not corporate culture of Merrill Lynch.
Their evidence to show that this is a class issue was BLB, who talked about corporate culture, who failed to explain whether the reason that African Americans are on teams at the rate that they are is success rather than race.
But they're making a disparate impact argument. They're not making a disparate treatment argument.
A disparate impact case turns, this court reminded us in Lewis, the statute says that the policy must be used in a way that causes a disparate impact.
And
the class question is whether...
Are there any offices of Merrill Lynch that do not leave teaming decisions up to the individual FAs?
No, that's
okay,
and in fact, the whole industry does that. The whole industry does that. But that, my point here is that is a discretionary decision that these plaintiffs themselves have explained. I want a team with someone successful. McReynolds said, I want a team with someone who can knock it out of the park. LaRue Gibson said, I want a team based on, I will choose my teammates based on personality, ability, and whether it's worth my while in terms of compensation. These are small businesses. They really run like a business within a business. They're very personal. It's like picking a partner that you're going to work with in a small firm. You're out there prospecting for new clients, servicing those clients. It's not something that Merrill Lynch can lay down and say you must team, because that won't serve any business interest. It won't serve our clients' interests, and it won't serve the FA's interests. I see my time is
waning.
Not over.
The teaming policy here is it's discretion all the way down. The account distribution policy has a few criteria, like the criteria that the Supreme Court considered in Walmart on the promotion side, a few criteria, and below that, it's all discretion. Walmart, we think, requires that when you have entirely discretionary, subjective decision-making, you can certainly judge whether there has been individual discrimination. If there was discrimination here, it occurred because of the individual decisions of an FA at a teaming decision or of a manager, and those can be addressed at the individual level.
For the JPML? I mean, if this is really so...
There may be the discovery that it's just more convenient and cheaper to do in that sort of a...
It has to be common. That's what 1407
I don't think it means the same thing as it does in class certification. I mean, there's been a lot of development of the law of commonality culminating in Walmart. And what Judge Gelman found is that there is no common issue here, nothing that could be C4.
So I don't see why it belongs. I mean, if he said there's a little bit and it would have established the pre-Walmart standards but not the post-Walmart standards, that would be one thing. If there's zero...
If there's a common issue that moves the case along, if there's a common issue that is, you know, that satisfies the standards for an injunction that, laid out in Randall and so on, if it really moves the case along, then you can certify an issue that really moves the case along. The plaintiffs here have not identified any issue that is common that would move this case to the next stage and wouldn't leave us with 700 or however many other individual inquiries we have afterwards.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Freer, your time has expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Wood, the distinction that you've drawn with respect to having policies versus having just a policy of discretion is one that Merrill Lynch pointed out to the district court. When the Walmart case had gone in favor of the Walmart plaintiffs, Merrill Lynch told the district court that the plaintiffs have not argued that Merrill Lynch had a uniform policy of permitting managers to make discretionary decisions. And Merrill Lynch told the court, and as plaintiffs concede, all the decisions about which plaintiffs complain were made within a framework of objective national policies. Manager discretion was exercised within these confines. And that is a critical distinction between this case and Walmart, because in Walmart, as the Supreme Court explained, that left no glue between all of the offices. Here, not only are all of the plaintiffs subject to the same uniform national policies, but they're ranked nationally. So Merrill Lynch takes all 14,000 brokers and cuts them top 20, next 20, next 20, next 20, and assigns a quintile ranking. So discrimination anywhere in the country impacts the ranking of every financial advisor and disproportionately affects African Americans.
Ms. Friedman, do the individual plaintiffs want to pursue individual disparate treatment claims as well as these class-based disparate impact claims?
Quite candidly, we wanted a class. We feel that's the best way to prove these claims. It's like if you flip a coin 100 times, you could get 99 heads and one tail. If you want to look at each coin toss individually, it's a 50-50 shot, and you could justify it. We wanted to proceed as a class. As the law developed, including having to incur this burden with the experts' reports and prove the case, it became more apparent that the violations were indeed class-wide violations. We appreciate and respect the Walmart decision and the difficulties of having the individual claims no longer be able to be under 23B2 for back pay. And so the post-Walmart brief presents the case asking for
class
certification under C4 so that each plaintiff who did want to pursue the individual claim would go into their hearing with the presumption under Teamsters.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Friedman and Mr. Bishop. Next case.